When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
The Book of Joe podcast is a production of iHeartRadio. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to the latest episode of the Book of Joe podcast with me, Tom Verducci, and Joe Madden. Joe, are you a big fan of Jeopardy by any chance?
I guess I am a big fan of Jeopardy. How could you not be a big fan of Jeopardy? Right?
You know how they have this once in a while category called potpourri?
Sure.
It's absolutely Kind of like a catch-all. By the way, potpourri is French for rotten pot. I never knew that before. That's a Jeopardy answer for you as well. Potpourri originally was a...
A rotten pot?
Yeah, it was a stew. You just throw a bunch of... You throw a bunch of mixed meats in a pot and it's a stew. That's a potpourri. And now it's a Jeopardy category. So we've got kind of a potpourri today.
All right.
We're going to have different categories. We're going to talk about our categories. The commish, start me up, the slump, and supergroups. It's all coming up today. Mm-hmm. But we're going to start with Hinchliffe. You and I were at the reopening of beautiful Hinchliffe Stadium in Paterson, New Jersey, one of two surviving Negro League ballparks. We were there for the dedication on Friday. It was quite the event. By the way, Rickwood Field in Alabama is the only other surviving ballpark where Negro League baseball was played. So Hinchcliffe had been shuttered for almost three decades, and now there will be professional baseball there, the New Jersey Jackals, an independent minor league team, for the first time since 1950. And what's most cool of all is all these kids now, I'm talking school kids, travel ball kids, can play football, soccer, baseball on the same field where Negro League stars played. I'm talking about Josh Gibson, Oscar Charlton, Cool Papa Bell, Larry Doby. And by the way, on that same field, because they played other sports as well, Jim Thorpe played there. Vince Lombardi played there. Babe Ruth attended boxing matches there. The history there is unbelievable. So, Joe, I'm curious what your take was being there at the event, being inside the beautiful walls of Hinchliffe Stadium.
Yeah, it was phenomenal. That's a really great intro to the whole thing. It's one of those surrealistic moments for me. And as we were standing on the field there, there was a bunch of dignitaries on the field. A lot of politicians had to speak. And then, of course, fans in the stands. But, I mean, it was kind of like a blustery, cool, but not cold day. Whereas it wasn't just sunny, but there's a bunch of clouds behind the ballpark there as we were facing towards school number five, right? Public school number five.
Yep.
And you look at it, and it could have been any year. It could have been any year. We were standing there listening to all this, listening to the different people talk about the rededication. Everybody was so thrilled about it. It was a very large buzz throughout the city as it tested by the traffic jam just trying to get into the place. So it was one of those moments that I won't forget. I did take a mental snapshot. And a lot of that is not lost. I mean, the people that had walked on that field before, all that stuff, pretty spectacular. Right? And the mayor, Andre, did a wonderful job, and Greg, his assistant, really he helped us a lot. But it was really all of that. I mean, it was a great take-in for us, and I'm really happy that we had a chance and the time to get there.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the school there, and you just think about for the last 25 to 30 years, if you were going to school there, you're looking out the window. You are looking at literally urban decay. Mm-hmm. The ballpark was falling apart. Graffiti strewn. You had trees of weeds growing out through the stands and the turf on the field. Just a complete eyesore. And now they're looking out there, and it's something you can dream on. It doesn't mean you have to dream on being a professional baseball player, but dreaming about opportunity. And that's, to me, what that ballpark is about, Joe, is, yeah, it's about opportunity, the chance to, whether it's concerts, baseball, football, boxing, you name it, that now should be, and I think will be, a real source of civic pride, a place for community to gather. And what's better than that?
Yeah, it's going to be inspiring to the kids looking out the windows, because that's what we do as kids in school. We look out windows, right? And they're going to be looking out there, and your description is right on. I mean, what they've done too with the turf all over the field, actually a track that surrounds it, that they, I guess, unzipped the turf on one side to complete the oval with the track itself, the scoreboards in center field. I like the signage, the Hinchcliffe Stadium, and, of course, the extension to the Negro League Museum, I guess, in right field, that I went to afterwards for like a little reception. Spectacular, all of it. And then the view out the back window there to the falls itself. And even Mayor Andre, somebody pointed out to me, there's one more chimney stack setting up right there in the middle. It's the old Colt 45 factory that had been sitting there, you know, how many years ago, but it's, the chimney stack still exists right there, right in the middle. I don't know, 150 yards, 200 yards from that particular building. So everything about it, really, it has a tremendous combination of old and new right now. But I love that, what the Art Deco component of the Hinchcliffe Stadium, tremendously done in the first place and beautifully restored.
Yeah, I love the fact that there is a museum component to that, because you and I were there, and we know about the history. You could feel the ghosts, really. You really could, yeah, because the exterior really hasn't changed much at all. As you mentioned, the Art Deco decor to it. It's just a really fabulous, cool place. But the stories will be told, and I'm sure they'll be told so well at that museum there, about the stadium, about the Negro Leagues, and the story that it's such an integral part of American opportunity and history, that it's so cool that generations now will get to tangibly feel and see that history and not just read about it in a book. And for me, Joe, I got to throw this in there. It's a little bit of personal history. For me, first time I was back there since playing a high school football game there in 1977. Believe me, when I played there, it was starting to decay, but it was like being inside an old mansion where you could feel the history, even if you knew it wasn't, you know, up to standards in terms of, you know, the maintenance of it. But boy, you could just, and I didn't even know the whole history, but you knew it was around for a while, and you knew there were ghosts there. It was really cool.
And I got to see exactly where you flanked out to the left facing, I don't know if that's north, south, east, or west end zone. I think it was running a fly pattern, catching it in stride and spiking the ball in the end zone and having your coach yell at you for doing that.
Yeah, well said. All right, we're going to move on to our next category here. And, you know, we lost a great baseball writer in Rick Hummel, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. They called him the commish. Now, it started out, he was the commissioner of kind of a football fantasy league, but he became known as the commish around baseball because he just was around baseball all the time and knew everything about it. One of the real gentlemen around the game, synonymous with covering Cardinals baseball through managers like Whitey Herzog, Tony La Russa, Joe Torre, you name it. He was there for so much history and chronicled it so well. He had just retired after last season, 77 years old, had a quick illness, died in his sleep over the weekend. But it's a big loss for the baseball community, especially in St. Louis, where you know how popular that team is and what it means to the city of St. Louis. And you just think about generations who grew up and their connection to the Cardinals was, in many ways, reading what Rick Hummel had to say covering that team. So I'm sure, Joe, you crossed paths with Rick on your trips through St. Louis or the Cardinals coming to Chicago.
Yeah.
It's a reminder of how important I think baseball writers can be, especially those who have such a long and distinguished career.
Yeah, gentlemen, absolute gentlemen. They always treated me well, properly. And yeah, I mean, it is. It's the sports writer. You know, it's not viewed in the same with the same reverence maybe that it had been in the past because of the way news is distributed today via this iPad that I'm utilizing right now. And you don't have as many columnists and really fine writers in each particular city that can dissect something in a way that I thought was, I think, maybe, tasty to both sides. Somebody that really was there on a more consistent basis and didn't just show up on occasion. Guys that were really fully entrenched in their craft and the teams and the group and the team and the teams that were coming through. So yeah, you always treated me really, really well. And you talked about the managers that had been there before. Whitey and I, Whitey's another one of the great influential managers in my particular existence because I was there with the Angels when he just came in the door for a brief period of time. And the history of the team, I was a fan in 1964 when they won the World Series, was the first year I was a Cardinal fan. So whether it's the sporting news, Rick, whatever, it's there's always been this wonderful group of writers there, and it's different. The Cardinals, the St. Louis fan base, they are different. They are traditionally based. They've had a great run for so many years back to Mr. Ricky, and so yeah, it's a tough one right there. I didn't realize it was such a quick illness like that, and that's tough to hear after just retiring. But sadly missed, but he was really a gentleman, is the best way I could describe it.
Yeah, well said. I mean, Rick was very involved with the Baseball Writers Association. He was a president for a while, and the Post-Dispatch started to fund a scholarship in his name over the years where they would have internships, and the interns would come out and work with Rick, actually, through summer internships. And I wanted to share some of his rules, sort of rules. They're not literally rules, but let's call them guideposts to pass along his knowledge and everything he's learned to the younger generation. So he had some rules. Again, I'm using that loosely. I'm sure there wasn't a fine or anything involved.
I used them loosely also, so I get it.
Okay. Number one, show up, be on time, right? I mean, you had that rule as a manager, right, Joe?
It's sure, of course.
The simplest thing you can do. Watch and listen closely. Tell the story. Don't be it. Dress better. Tweet less. And never forget to have fun. I mean, you can't go wrong with those.
I'd like to think I could have written that. I mean, that's right on the money right there. That's a simple mantra to follow. What, five lines, whatever that was. And if we all did that on a daily basis, you know what? People would like to speak with you. People want to be around you. You're going to make a positive impact. Whatever you put out there comes back to you. It's all encapsulated in what you just said, those simple rules. It's outstanding. And again, most of us need to adhere to that more on a daily basis because it's that simple and it's that good.
Yeah, and I think especially younger writers need to be told tweet less. Not that there's anything wrong with tweeting, but I think it's sort of like going around in life when you see people using their phones for selfies or they're at some beautiful place or some place in nature and they're viewing it through their phones and not through their own experience. And I feel that way people covering baseball, that they're not really watching. And as Yogi would say, you can learn a lot by observing or watching. And, you know, I think it's well said. It's very short. It's sweet. Tweet less. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with it, but make sure that you soak up the experience. You learn so much that way.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to tweeting and, you know, writers during a game, I would hope that they're doing it in between innings and not actually as action is occurring. When you put your head down, you lose the game. I mean, even in a dugout, I want to write something down, but if I don't wait for a break in the action and I go to write something and all of a sudden I look up and I missed, I get so angry with myself if I miss something. It's like, for instance, if they started a runner and I had been worried that we're looking at something else that was really not pertinent and I missed the sign from the third base coach as an example, I'd get upset with myself. So yeah, it's okay to tweet, I guess, you know, it's there and it has a positive purpose. But when you're doing something like that, when you're writing the story of the game, you got to watch the game and you got to analyze the game according to what you are seeing, what you believe is the right things to do, not to be influenced by somebody sitting in a home somewhere trying to tell you how to think in regards to what you're seeing in this baseball game. I'm always concerned about that a little bit. I like the writer that just sits there and gives me his solid opinion and not somebody else's.
Joe, speaking of opinions, I can't wait to get your opinion on this next category called Start Me Up.
Okay.
The state of starting pitching in Major League Baseball these days. In one word, it stinks. We'll be back right after this.
Start me up the Stones, man.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? Does the thought of social events make you feel excited or exhausted? It's easy for people to ignore their social batteries and spread themselves thin, especially at this time of year, when gatherings are picking up again after the winter. But it's important to find the right amount of socializing for you and still give yourself the time to recharge. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And when you're feeling worn out from socializing, therapy can help give you the tools you need to take care of yourself and recharge. Because a full battery is the key to a full life. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Book of Joe today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Book of Joe.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Hey, welcome back to the Book of Joe podcast. Yeah, starting pitching. Man, we've been traveling downhill for the last decade, Joe. You've seen it happen. Looking at the numbers, this is only the third season ever where the winning percentage of starting pitchers is this low and the ERA is this high. And those other years were 2019 and 2020. We're asking starters to do less. They're throwing fewer innings. They're pitching less often. They're getting hurt more, and they're winning less. 10 years ago, starting pitchers accounted for 70% of the wins in a baseball season. We're down to 59% now. And in those 10 years, the average number of pitches from a starter has gone from 97 to 86. Here's something that's amazing to me. We've already used 232 starting pitchers in a quarter of a season this year. That's more than entire seasons from 1901 to 1974. And there are more starting pitchers on the IL so far this year. Again, we haven't played a third of the season. There are more starting pitchers on the IL than were on for the entire season in 2016. That's only 7 years ago, folks. So workload's dropping. Injuries are going up. Teams will spend probably almost $400 million this year on pitchers who can't pitch.
Yeah.
And they're doing this, by the way, by going to most teams, going to six-man rotations.
Mm-hmm.
Normal rest in today's game is not four, folks. If you hear an announcer say he's gone on normal rest, that means 5 days. You know, 10 years ago, it was normal. Now, only 30% of starts are made on the fifth day. So, Joe, you were part of it. I mean, you saw it. You had the six-man rotation with Shohei. I get that, to accommodate him with the Angels. I don't see this trend reversing. I'm not saying it's good or it's bad. I'm just saying that the game now pivots almost more on relief pitching than it does on starting pitching. A starting pitcher, to me now, his job, work through the lineup two times, don't lose the game. Just keep the team around, be a game manager, if you will. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's really that component has been analytically driven. The third time through, the batting order has really become a prominent refrain over the last several years. That's all I heard. I heard that a lot with different pitchers, and I'm going to jump around a bit, but I had guys in the past that, yeah, I knew that the third time through was be careful and you don't want them out there. But I also know that the third time through for some others, they would even get better. They were trained. They were trained in a way that they wanted to conclude what they began. So it is disturbing, and it's a learned behavior on our part. This is how we're teaching our young pitchers to play. And it starts in the minor leagues. I don't even know what's going on in college. Normally in the past, collegiate coaches would let their guys go because they had less of them and they're trying to win, and weekends would be very, very important. And, you know, back in the day, I watched ASU, Jim Brock use his best pitcher on Saturday or Friday and Sunday. So I don't know what the college trend is like. But I do know professionally, like you said, it's less innings and more injuries. I think part of it also with the injury, again, spitballing, is just the fact that nobody's being taught to pitch. Everybody's being taught to throw hard and spin the ball at the top of the strike zone primarily. Now the sweep slider is becoming a more prominent pitch. It's just a bigger slider. And Mark Clear of Horse had one of the best I've ever seen in 1980 or 79-8 when I caught him. It's the same pitch that's being made more prominent right now, become more popular. But this all this stuff's been around. We're not nurturing guys to pitch more deeply in the games. It's not being encouraged in the minor leagues. And again, I always go back there because that's where it needs to be done. It has to be a mindset that the pitcher wants to complete what he began. I watched Cincinnati yesterday. I don't remember the pitcher's name. I was watching the game. It was like the fourth or fifth inning. And he was doing okay, left-hander. And he was taken out. He was taken out, kind of a little bit tight, but middle of the ball game, a lot of game left. And, man, wait, like you're talking about, where are you going to get all these pitchers from? If you keep taking your starters out that early. But the point is, as he gave the ball to the manager and he was walking off, he was pretty content. You know, there was no John Lackey moment right there. This is – this. I've learned to do this. I've learned that, okay, I've done my job. I'll go in, I'll get some treatment, I'll lift some weights, I'll watch the game, and I'll come back tomorrow and I'll start this cycle of getting back ready for my next ball game. It's an acceptance that we have taught, this acceptance of not being expected to go more deeply in the game. So if it's been a learned behavior to do it this way, why can't we reteach it the other way? And part of it, I think, and I'll shut up here, is that it's not just about throwing the ball hard. We have to teach guys how to pitch, and pitchers have to be able to maneuver through the lineup into the third time, into the sixth, seventh inning. I saw Verlander the other day just shoving with his fastball. I watched that game against, was that Cleveland?
Yes, against Cleveland.
Shoving with his fastball, and they were late. I mean, and that was just an attitude on his part. It wasn't like a pedestrian velocity in today's game, 94-95, but he was shoving because of his attitude and his commitment to each pitch. So, man, it's just what's being taught. It's the third time through syndrome, and I'd like to see more nurturing in the minor leagues of letting guys go farther into the game, and more of a pitchability as opposed to a throwability.
Yeah, it reminds me of a line from Curt Schilling, who said, starting pitchers, they're like Labrador retrievers. They'll do what you train them to do.
Right.
And we are training them to pitch two times around the lineup and say, I did my job.
Right.
It's definitely an attitude. I think what you're saying, if I read you correctly, Joe, because the third time around metric, there's some real facts there, right? It's hard to dispute that in general, a fresh arm is better than a guy pitching through the lineup a third time.
Right.
But I said in general. So I think what you're arguing against is a one-size-fits-all mentality, that there are certain pitchers that should be, if not trained to do it, they can do it, and you'll never know unless you give them the opportunity.
Yeah, and I think it's about pitchability. I mean, I've always liked my starters that had a third and even a fourth pitch so that they're not showing the same thing the third time through that they've shown the first time through the batting order. They have a different look for this particular hitter. That's really a good starting pitcher. The ability to change speeds, the ability to locate, the ability to put the ball on the ground or elevate when he wants to. But they're not doing this on the minor league level. This is where it has to begin. You just don't bring somebody up and expect them to know how to do all this stuff automatically on a major league level. There are going to be some horses, some anomalies. The kid with the Atlanta, he's probably an anomaly. But I do believe there's more out there. If, in fact, you give them the opportunity, if, in fact, on a minor league level, you encourage and teach them to maneuver through the third time through the batting order. Listen, if it was like the right way to do things, who'd be losing right now? I mean, there's a lot of teams that are struggling. There's a lot of teams that can't get anybody out. You're talking about the state of starting pitching. So why is this the right way to do things? I don't get it. It's the way it's being done right now, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's right. And that's where I get confused with all this stuff, because if it's not, if it was as easy as just applying this kind of doctrine to our organizational philosophy, then I would expect more wins, and it's just not happening everywhere.
No, it's not. And you made a good point about pitchability. I looked at four-seam fastball velocity by inning this year. Mm-hmm. And for starting pitchers, the highest average velocity, you got it. It's the first inning. Mm-hmm. And then it goes down in the second. It goes down in the third. It goes down in the fourth. It goes down in the fifth. And then in the sixth inning, when bullpens take over, it starts ramping up again until we get to the ninth inning, of course, where you have the highest average four-seam velocity at 95. But starting pitchers now are taking the ball from their very first pitch of the game as if they're closing the game. It's a game predicated on swings and misses, even from the first inning. And that's why you're seeing walks are up and strikeouts are up. I see pitchers all the time. They realize, hey, a walk is not a bad play.
Correct.
So I'm going to spin the baseball even when I'm behind on the count. I'll live with the walk, and I will all the times try for that strikeout for the swing and miss. It's part of what guys are paid for, right? The swing and miss, keeping the ball out of play. So we're encouraging our starters to go at the game like they're closers.
And that's, you know, back when we were doing this a couple of years ago, there was a lot of talk about pitching to contact. I mean, that was a big line back in the 80s when I first began. And that's where defenses, you know, you wanted to put your defense obviously in the right spot. And you wanted somebody to be able to pick up a ground ball, because a lot of times you did have sinker ball pitchers that would pitch to contact. My theory as a minor league coordinator was to get an out. I wanted my pitchers to get an out within the first three pitches of an at-bat. You know, the longer the at-bat, the more pitches seen, obviously, that the hitter had a greater advantage. And, of course, with that, more pitches thrown per at-bat, then the starting pitcher has less of a chance to go more deeply into the game. I remember doing that with kids in the minor league, and I did it with guys in the big leagues. I wanted the out within the first three pitches. But that's not the case, like you're saying. We're going to keep trying to strike you out at the expense of five, six, seven, eight pitches because I'm not going to give in. I'm going to keep rearing back and throwing as hard as I possibly can. There is not that pitchability. Of course, there is Kyle Hendricks. I had James Shields. I could start naming guys that had great pitchability. They're able to pitch more deeply into the game. I didn't really manage with this philosophy a whole long regarding just, you know, elevated velocity, rear back and throw as hard as you can. Jake McGee was that, as an example, out of the bullpen. He just threw fastball, left-handed fastball, and everybody was crying that he needs a breakable. I said, no, he doesn't. Just needs to keep throwing that same pitch over and over again. I think one year righties hit .99 against Jake, but that was a one-inning guy. It was not the whole game. But my pitchers with the Rays, and even look at the guys with the Cubs, they were pitchers. They had pitchability about them. They were there. They were able to get the third time through. So I understand statistically, but I think the statistics are skewed by just what you've talked about. If you just get a bunch of dudes out there just trying to throw as hard as they can and velocity comes down the third time through and these hitters are seeing the same slot, the limited number of pitches or kind of pitches that this guy can throw, of course he's going to narrow them down. It's all interconnected. So I like pitchability. I like guys out there know what they're doing. I want my pitchers. My starters can go into the sixth, seventh inning. That really makes my bullpen a whole lot better.
Well, just since 2015, and that's not too long ago, the percentage of major league starts lasting seven innings has been cut by more than half. It used to be over 30%. Now we're about 12%.
There you go.
So we're not getting that length from starting pitchings. I get it. I understand there's more power arms in the bullpen. And you know, as a manager, Joe, these guys are more likely to hurry to their bullpen because they have a bevy of choices out there. I always say, the worst mistake a manager can make in the game today, it seems to me, is leaving a starting pitcher in to lose the game late. No manager wants a starting pitcher to lose a game after the sixth inning because there's questions to answer. Well, why didn't you go to the bullpen, right? So we're not allowing those pitchers even the opportunity to pitch through a jam a second or third time.
That's what the minor leagues are for, man. That's where these guys have to learn how to do this stuff, and they will. You give them the opportunity, they'll learn how to change speeds, manipulate the ball somewhat, see what the hitter's looking like, what is he doing, give them an opportunity to learn how to do this. You just can't expect somebody that's never done it before to show up on a major league stage and all of a sudden manipulate and figure out how to get into that third time through the bat. He's not. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. I love the minor leagues. That's how I grew up, and I still love the minor leagues. I haven't seen it in a while. But that's the lab, man. That's the lab. That's where these things need to be taught. This is where things have to be stretched in a sense. But if you're going to just teach specialization from the time the guy shows up out of a high school, college, or junior college, and it's all about specialization, and this is your niche, and once you get to this number, I'm going to come get you. You walk off the mound, and you're going to be happy about it. That's what you're going to get.
Yeah, you know, I understand wins often are a product of how many runs your team scores, the defense behind you. Obviously, the pitcher doesn't have complete command of a win or lose situation. But, man, I don't care. The win, say 20 wins in the season or having that W next to your name, man, that still matters. That means you stayed in the game long enough to work through maybe a jam a second or third time. You not only gave your team a chance to win, but you got that win yourself because you lasted long enough to do that. And I think with wins comes glamour, comes prestige. We're losing that.
Yeah.
That, you know, the no decision, who cares? I mean, like Ed Lynch, the old pitcher and GM once told me, it's the only position in sports we literally build a pedestal for. Mm-hmm. The pitcher is on a mound. The starting pitcher should be a drawing card, and we're losing that kind of glamour, that kind of drawing power, if you will, to see a big-time pitcher go out there. You know, nobody walked into a bar and impressed anybody by talking about their whip or their strikeout rate. But if you said, hey, I won 20 games, you're like, wow, that's a 20-game winner.
Yeah.
So it still matters. And again, I'm not saying that's the best evaluation of a pitcher, but from a fan perspective, yeah, it matters, folks.
it's not a bad evaluation. It really is not. And, you know, I agree with you on all those different counts. Buddy Black and I, Pepe, manager of the Rockies, we used to look at the paper. When we looked at the paper, and it says marquee matchup. You look at a particular city and the two pitchers, there's two starting pitchers. It's a marquee matchup today. JoJo, we'd walk into a ballpark. Our guy was good. Their guy was good. JoJo, marquee matchup today. You don't hear that anymore. You don't. You're absolutely right. You do not hear that. Why? What's that was a draw. It should be a draw. You know, Verlander and Scherzer pitching back-to-back in a doubleheader, that was pretty – that had some marquee stuff attached to it yesterday, whatever it was with the Mets. It should be re-nurtured. I do. I still look at the starting pitchers, and there's times – like Manoah. I like Manoah with Toronto as an example. As in the other dugout, I thought this guy was really, really good, and I know he got caught in that controversy the other day. But as an example, I will want to watch him pitch when I know that he's pitching in a particular game. I'll tune in just for that reason. And there's still some guys that I like that. But industry-wide, it really would be great to get back to that. But again, it's not going to happen if it's not deemed to be important analytically and if it's not taught on the minor league level. And I don't understand why, like I said, the kid walking off the mound from Cincinnati was totally content with getting out of there when he did, as opposed to really wanting to finish what he started. Isn't it a life lesson in some way too? Don't we all want to finish what we start? And I don't know. It's just there's not a whole lot to be derived from that. And again, you got to show me on an annual basis that just a ton, plethora of relief pitchers is going to get it done on an annual basis. Yeah, the guy coming in is going to throw harder. I get that. But that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be better or win. I'll take my chances with a good starting staff that gets me consistently to the sixth inning, that permits me to use my bullpen less and keep those guys fresh for the playoffs. I still prefer that method.
Well, Joe, we've got two more categories on our baseball Jeopardy board. Okay. Slumps and super groups.
Cool.
We'll be back at it after this.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
We went from normal life, healthy child, to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
Hey, Joe, I got a question for you. Do you remember ever having a really bad slump as a minor leaguer or maybe in college?
my whole life. Yeah. I, you know, every year at Lafayette, the cold weather, even though I'm from the cold weather, man, that first month I'd be looking, swinging at pitches and I'd see them going over the bat. I'm thinking, what am I doing wrong here? And I needed the weather to warm up to find out where the head of the bat needed to be. So yes, we've all been involved in slumps.
Well, Trace Thompson of the LA Dodgers is on the longest hitless slump of any position player in Dodgers history. This is a guy who started the year with 3 home runs in his first game. Figured he's heading for a great year, right? He's gone 0-for-38. That's more than a month without a hit. He's not an everyday player, of course, so he's not getting a lot of ABs. Imagine going like 5-6 weeks without a hit. 0-for-38. I remember Derek Jeter once, 0-for-32, which is like crazy for a future Hall of Famer. I remember Derek one time, he was so desperate for a hit. He tried to bunt for a base hit with a guy on second base and 2 outs. Not normally a good play, but he did it. He needed a hit, didn't get it. Wound up breaking out of it with a home run of Barry Zito. The worst slump, I think, of all time, certainly in recent times, 0-for-54 by Chris Davis of the Baltimore Orioles. We're not talking about pitchers. There's been some historic ones on for pitchers, but position players. So I'm curious, Joe, when you've got one of your players going through those slumps, and as you know, they tend to take a life of its own. Mm-hmm. What can you do to try to get a guy out of it?
I try to simplify primarily, and I really do. I try to get out of the mechanical component, just get into the mental component, like try to reduce the task at hand here. As an example, I just emphasize middle of the field. We just got to stay in the middle. Look away first, slow the pitch down. Really, the whole field has to become your friend again, because a lot of times that guy gets in a pull mode, rollover mode, chase mode. That's what happens in long slumps. It's rare that you're hitting the ball hard consistently and it's right at people and it's caught. It's normally weak contact and chase. So I like to do that. I like to get them to narrow it down and think middle first, like I said, and opposite side. And the farther the ball is away from your body, the deeper you let it get. In other words, you got more time. So these are the kind of things I will talk about. I really want to stay away from physical mechanics. That's just going to bog it down even more. So I always do begin with that, with the hitter. And then we've talked about this too. It depends on the status of the guy also. And if he's going to go for 30-something on like a Jeter did, of course he's an everyday player. You're not going to sit him. I like moving those guys up in the batting order as opposed to below. And my thought is, listen, I want you to just try to get on base somehow. Just get on base. Stop thinking about hits. Just get on base. And I also believe if they start accepting their walks, that's when the hits start showing up, because again, they start getting their strike zone in order. So this is where I come from when I get a guy that's really struggling like that. We've all had them. But I think the worst thing you can do is start to try to get mentally mechanical, physically mechanical. It's more of your mental mechanics that are messing up on you as opposed to your physical mechanics. And I think during the course of a baseball season, the deeper you get, the more your mechanical work needs to be mental mechanics as opposed to physical.
Hey, I love what you said about moving the guy up in the order. Joe Torre was a big proponent of that. That, as you said, you kind of take the onus off getting a hit to just get on base. And oftentimes, especially if you move a guy to the number 2 spot, which Joe liked to do, you're surrounded by good hitters. You may see some more fastballs. You just slot it into a good spot in the order. And I think I personally like the message that you're sending, that I'm with you. I think when you move guys down in the lineup, what you're doing is you're trying to take pressure off a guy, but you're basically giving into the slump and saying, you know what, you're not going well now, so I have to drop you in the order. Right. It's sort of a negative reinforcement to me. So I like the counterintuitive move of moving the guy up in the lineup.
One more thing, Tommy, too. The other thing I like to do there is put a hit and run sign on. I'll force the guy to swing the bat. So you're just trying to pick a pitcher that's around the strike zone, maybe a sinker ball pitcher. Ball might be on the ground. But if we're facing a command pitcher, run the zone, somewhat of a sinker ball guy, I will try to pick a count to get the runner started, because now the hitter totally commits to swing the bat in that situation. I've had some success with that with pretty good hitters that are in a little bit of a slump. Because you're in the maybe mode. A lot of the slump is the maybe mode. Should I swing? Should I not swing? And then that, of course, whenever you're in the maybe mode, it never works. So you got to get them to see the ball, commit to the pitch. So I do like an automatic hit and run to get him to swing the bat. Regardless of what happens, at least he commits to the swing, and sometimes he comes out feeling better about it.
The mental component is amazing, isn't it, Joe? I mean, slump of that kind of like crazy length, it becomes such a mental weight. And we're talking about the finest athletes of the game getting to that level. You have to be competitive. You have to be able to persevere just to get there. But then it's amazing how the confidence can just wither to nothing when you can't buy a hit for a week, for a couple of weeks, in this case, 5 weeks. What about the mental side of it, Joe? Is there anything that you can do, try to change a guy's routine, laugh about it? I know a lot of people, like Jeter, like a lot of players, he would never want to say the S word, slump. Mm-hmm. Guys don't even want to say that. It's like on defense with the yips. Nobody ever wants to say the yips. They call it the thing. The slump just becomes almost a character, a beast in its own way.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you're swinging too much. I think there's a point of diminishing returns with all this too. So I'll actually ask my guy to swing less or just show up and play. You know, come in later today. Just come in late. Don't even go to the cage. Just come in, stretch, do your treatment, whatever it is. When you see that first pitch in the game, that's the first pitch you're seeing all day, as an example. Or just overall less batting practice. Sometimes we swing ourselves into slumps. I'll say his name, Jackie Howell. I love Jackie Howell. Jackie was a young angel, and I remember working with him in Tucson. He was up to the big league club, sent him back down. He was having some issues. We go to Tucson. I'm throwing BP. It's kind of hot. And he's killing it. He's absolutely killing it. But then one more. And when you do that, if you roll something over, pop something up, again, I want one more. So we should have quit after 4 or 5 minutes. We were there for almost a half an hour based on one more. So those are the kind of things a good hitting coach has to be able to tell his guy, listen, no, that's enough. That's enough today. Let's move it along. Just put the bat down, because there's arm weariness, there's mental weariness, there's all kinds of weariness that's going to occur. Like just continually swinging. And then when you do that, you're practicing the wrong things anyhow. So I'd like a hitting coach to take charge of that moment. And sometimes it's less is more. And you have to understand that, because I've seen so many guys that just, you want to swing yourself out of a slump. It's like going out of the driving range. Okay. You had a couple good, just leave. George Hendricks was the best. I used to throw Cuz BP as a young coach, and Cuz was an angel. And we go down to the cage at Gene Autry with his little helmet on. And he says, I want about 15. That's it. He would say that. Then I'd go and I'd throw a couple pitches. He would always adjust after each pitch. And maybe after 10, he hits a bullet. He says, I'm good. And he'd walk out. He would just walk out. Love Cuz's approach. Cuz was pretty good. So everybody, and we have taught hitters to swing way too much, I think. That's because of the nature of the way teaching occurs right now. And we always think more is better. And I do not subscribe to that theory at all. Less is more a lot of times. And again, a good hitting coach knows when to say timeout. That's enough.
Well said, brother. One more category on our Baseball Jeopardy board, and that is super groups. Joe, the 1970s, man, what is it about rock bands in the 1970s? Because there were super groups. I mean, mm-hmm. You have people who went on to talented solo careers getting together in these super groups. And I love the way that they told stories. You know, we started out talking about Rick Hummel, mm-hmm. and the storytelling involved with baseball writing. I think about bands in the 70s, whether it was rock operas, you know, concept albums, or just long songs that had an arc of a story to it. I mean, you just don't see those anymore. Obviously, you're talking about groups like Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, The Who, The Eagles, Fleetwood Mac, Chicago, Kansas, Boston. That sounds like a college conference. Chicago, Kansas, Boston. So I know this is up your alley, Joe.
Yeah.
70s bands. Where are you going if you want to throw on an album? Imagine that concept. Not just a song, but an album.
Wow. That's wide open, man.
Because the kids today, man, they don't even know what an album is, right? Yeah. I mean, you just go through your playlist. It's one song after another by different groups. But back in the day, when you had to throw that turntable on, You went through the album.
Oh, yeah.
You got the arc of an album. Yeah. There was concepts to the album. One song kind of dovetailed into another, or there was a theme there. It was amazing. It held you through the course of that needle working its way across that disc.
I mean, I could go, I mean, to begin with, it was always, I mean, I started in the early 70s with Elton John with Tumbleweed Connection. I've always considered that one of his best, or Madman Across the Water. But, and then Grand Funk Railroad, you talked about this operatic. It was I'm Your Captain, Grand Funk Railroad. And then you go into the mid 70s and Green Grass and High Tides by the Outlaws.
The Prairie League, yeah.
That to me is like one of the best jams in history, long jams. But when it just came to listening to an album, like from start to finish, because you liked every song. I liked Elton John for that. I liked Crosby, Stills, and Nash for that. I liked The Who for that. God, I could keep going on. I mean, of course, Springsteen began in 72-3 for me, and Greetings from Asbury Park is still one of my favorites. I will, if I need to be picked up for any reason, I'll just throw that on. Real, I got these Sirwin Vega, I think I told you, Sirwin Vega speakers right here to my right, each weighing 125 pounds. And I could Bluetooth my music through that, or I do have a turntable up on top there, and I just pound that real loud. Like I said, I'll turn the lights out at night. How about like Led Zeppelin, man? I mean, yeah. Zeppelin is another one. That's the one group now. If they ever, whatever's left of them, decided to get back together, I'm going. I don't know where it's going to be. I'm going. If Zeppelin ever decided we're going to do this another time, I will absolutely attempt to get there as well as I possibly can, because that group there, I always stop and listen to Zeppelin. The creativity of that group was phenomenal. David Bowie. I'm a big David Bowie fan. So I listen on and on. But when it comes down to just listening to an album, I love John, Elton John. I love Springsteen. And yeah, shoot, all these dudes, man. I can even go like to Molly Hatchet. I mean, all these guys, they were just such from, and the other thing was identifiable. You knew it was them. You know, the sound was their sound. You knew who you were listening to, even after five notes. Santana, I'm hoping to see him this summer. So, yeah, I could go on and on.
Yeah, I'm always blown away by how many great tracks the Eagles cranked out.
Sure.
I mean, we know they're a super group and unbelievable, but man, it's just one. And not just hits, but just one great tune after another. You may have answered this already, but when you mentioned Grand Funk Railroad, give me one sort of under the radar 1970s supergroup rock band that people should dig into. For me, I'm going to throw out their Bad Company.
Yeah.
They kind of got lost in the shuffle, but man, they cranked out a lot of really good music, great guitar riffs. Mm-hmm. As you said, a unique sound, right? All these groups kind of stood on their own merits. They kind of borrowed from one another, but you know, the tune comes on, you know, hey, that's Bad Company. Mm-hmm. ELO was that way as well. You know, another band to me probably has a very unique sound, and it was easy for some of these bands to get lost with, you know, between Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, Rolling Stones. But man, they hold up even years later. So who you got as your under the radar draft pick here?
I don't mean the Allman Brothers, are they under the radar? I mean, I love the Allman Brothers.
Yeah.
I love the Allman Brothers. I love that country rock, Marshall Tucker Band.
Yeah. That's some good jam bands.
Yeah. You also had, New Riders of the Purple Sage. This is a big Lafayette gig back then, all these guys. But if I had to pick one, that'll get me rolling too, that I guess it's under the radar somewhat, is the Allman Brothers. Just Jessica, I could listen to that jam all day long. I'm gonna stick with the Allman Brothers. So popularity wise, I'm sure that, you know, we know we're talking about with that. Of course we love them, but a lot of the younger generation, I'm not so sure that they're totally aware of who the Allman Brothers were and what they did, because their sound was spectacular for me.
Yeah. And, you know, we just to go back to starting pitching, these bands in the 70s, like starting pitchers, they were not in a hurry to get out of there. I mean, these songs went on 4 or 5, maybe 6 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Not happening today. Nobody's going to cut a single, because that's what they do now. That's even 4 minutes. So when you're talking about the Allman Brothers and some of these bands, man, they took their time. They really slow cooked their product. It was great.
They had a lot to say, man. This was pent up inside them for years. And at that time, it wasn't, didn't necessarily have to be an AM radio kind of a star. These albums were different, and they were made to be devoured. I mean, you just sat around and when a new album would come out, you'd get that, you'd get the plastic off, you'd very carefully put it down, make sure that needle came down properly, and you would just sit there and, you know, it was like watching Netflix, I guess, today. That was what an album was, or Hulu. That's what we did, and it was
binge listening.
Right, exactly, binge listening, exactly. And then you start talking among your buddies like about whatever you just had listened to. All time, longest one-hit wonder, how about Iron Butterfly and Gata da Vida? Ooh, how about that? That'll always stir you up, man. But that was beautiful when they came out with that.
Golden Earring, The Twilight Zone.
Love. That's one of my favorites, actually. That's right. That's right. Love Golden Earring.
Hey, man, this really been fun, Joe, playing Baseball Jeopardy with you. We'll have to do it again. But in the meantime, for Final Jeopardy, I'm going to ask you to give us something to take us out here on this latest edition of the Book of Joe podcast.
Yeah, I'm always saying with my guys, you know, the people that I really dig on, and this, I think, applies. We're just kind of talking about it right now. Churchill again, sorry. Love the man. Wish I'd had a drink with him. Success is going from failure to failure without losing your enthusiasm, right? I mean, everybody wants everything to be perfect all the time, but it ain't that way. It's not that way. You know, guys, we get hurt. Things just aren't working properly. We're thinking it too much. And it creates failure, but you got to go from failure to failure, and do not lose your enthusiasm. Energy and enthusiasm really is what leads to success on a high level. So I think Winston was well ahead of his time.
And one of the great speakers of all time, Winston Churchill. So I'm going to give you a quote from one of my son's elementary school teachers. It's not from Winston's playbook, not nearly as erudite, but mistakes are good. They're how we grow. They teach us things we need to know. And you're absolutely right. I mean, anybody involved in baseball can tell you about that, right? A game built on failure.
It is.
Makes you better.
And if you're right, if you can't handle it, then you can't do it. You can't play the game. If you can't handle the failure, you can't play the game.
And I love the part about the enthusiasm, getting through it with enthusiasm. Awesome.
100%. 100%.
It's been a pleasure, Joe. Let's do Baseball Jeopardy again another time.
I loved it. Well done, buddy. Well done.
The Book of Joe podcast is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah! And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, ah, yeah. Love that!
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in!
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it!
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.